that's where he lost me, Bernard, on that word work. I'd been working for him ever since we were married. I worked while he studied for his master's, his PhD, and while he held research jobs that paid practically nothing. And now he was asking me to work for the rest of my life to make him president of the United States one day. Well, I don't want to work for a man anymore. All I really want to do is play the horses.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a rousing edition of the U.S. Racing Sports Gambling Show. I am your friendly host, Derek Simon, and this is the show where we talk about everything and anything related to sports gambling, and quite the show on tap today. Of course, we've got all the big-time football games on New Year's Day, then the NFL. So Kevin Rogers of VegasInsider.com will drop by, and we'll talk about some of those big football games. But before we get to all of that, there are a few things that you simply need to know.
I'm looking forward to completing your training. In time, you will call me Master.
All righty then. I learn it from a book.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're gonna remember this the rest of your life.
Oh, I already knew that.
What part didn't you understand?
Will you never learn?
Tell you I can't. Yes.
Well, the first thing you need to know is on the horse racing front, and many of you will remember, I talked about it, I wrote about it, the Run Happy saga. Run Happy, the Breeders' Cup sprint champion. And it was like the day after or 2 days after the Breeders' Cup when the trainer, Maria Burrell, was fired. And it just created a firestorm on social media. People cannot stand the ownership group of Run Happy. Felt that Maria Burrell was given the shaft, as they say. Run Happy came back in the Malibu, 7-furlong race at Santa Anita. And the word on social media was that Run Happy was depressed and that Run Happy was not going to be happy because Maria Burrell was no longer there. I don't want to make light of the situation. I'm certainly not poking fun at Maria Burrell or even the people on social media who believe this. Well, I'm kind of poking fun at them because it's so silly. It's this notion of continually putting human emotions onto an animal when we have no clue what Run Happy is thinking. Just doesn't make a lot of sense. Not only that, but we've seen athletes before, human athletes, who have lost coaches, who have lost people close to them. You know, people who have had family members that have passed away, they go out, they play, they perform, because they're athletes. So Run Happy was faced with just this challenge in the Malibu Stakes, and it went a little something like this.
They're off. It was a very clean beginning, and Run Happy is sent right to the front. He quickly takes the lead. Marking came away in good order and is now rushing up to challenge him in second. Just behind them, Bad Reed Sanchez third through the opening furlong, and Lord Nelson not far away, three lengths off Run Happy. Watershed is next, then it's El Kabir, and Pain and Misery is the trailer. 5 furlongs to run in the Malibu, and Run Happy shows the way 3/4 of a length. Marking tries to put some pressure on him second. Then it's Bad Reed Sanchez third, Lord Nelson fourth, 4 lengths off the lead, and Run Happy starts to sneak away into the far turn. Watershed is in fifth. He's 7 lengths off the leader. El Kabir is asked to pick it up. Pain and Misery is far back. Less than 3/8 of a mile to go, and Run Happy's clear by 2.5 lengths. Marking is fully extended in second. Lord Nelson is third. He's 4 lengths off Run Happy at the top of the stretch. Watershed is far back than El Kabir. Top of the lane, Gary Stevens has been the perfect passenger for Run Happy. He's clear by 4. Marking trying his best, and he's starting to close the gap just a bit. 16th pole. Run Happy is simply super. He polishes off an outstanding campaign with a dominant victory in the Malibu.
So Run Happy, despite being depressed, wins in dominant fashion. And here's the kind of funny thing to me. You know, I had talked to the connections of Run Happy about, I don't know, a month ago, whenever, about the Breeders' Cup time. So I guess we're talking like 2 months ago. And they expressed a desire at that point, a goal of winning the 2016 Breeders' Cup Classic. And when that was expressed, a lot of folks, again, on social media just thought it was goofy and showed how crazy they are and how out of touch and how they're abusing the horse and so forth and so on. Well, I found this interesting, an article by Steve Davidowitz. Of course, Steve Davidowitz has been on this program. He is the author of Betting Thoroughbreds, a longtime handicapper and commentator. And he talks about the fact that he thinks that Run Happy could win the Breeders' Cup Classic. This from a column that he wrote for Gaming Today. He said, actually, I believe Run Happy will stretch out nicely in distance for his, quote, new trainer, the former stable manager, Laura Wohlers, who fired Maria Burrell. So if Wohlers decides to challenge Run Happy, I expect he will not only win the prestigious Metropolitan Mile at Belmont Park on Memorial Day, he just might be the horse to beat in the 1¼-mile, $5 million Breeders' Cup Classic at Santa Anita, November 5th, 2016. And honestly, there's nothing in Run Happy's pedigree to suggest that he can't go a mile and a quarter. He's a son of Super Saver who won the Kentucky Derby. His dam sire is Broken Vow, who was a distance horse. The only thing that initially concerned me about Run Happy is he looks so keyed up all the time. I mean, he looks like a sprinter. He runs like a sprinter. But you watch that Malibu, and that was a horse who was very, very relaxed. Looks like he can absolutely stretch out. And I felt the Malibu posed some challenges. Now, Run Happy was by far the best horse in the field. He was the only Grade 1 winner. In fact, he'd won 2 Grade 1 races. None of the other horses had won a Grade 1 race. And frankly, just wasn't a super strong field. But he won it like you should win in a race where you are favored to win, just like American Pharoah in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Now, also relating to horse racing, Trevor Denman, who, of course, is bowing out as a track announcer at Santa Anita, he's been doing it for many, many years. In fact, his race-calling career spans 44 years. But Trevor Denman is big into horse welfare. And since we're talking about Run Happy and the whole horse welfare thing, I've maintained for a long time, and one of the reasons I was so interested in the Run Happy story right from the get-go, and I took a lot of abuse for not being a fawning member of the media that just goes along with whatever was being said. Oh, these guys are terrible. This ownership group is terrible. How dare you do this? Just not my take on that story. And like I said, I took some heat for it. But one of the things I've seen, you know, as a database guy, as somebody who gathers numbers and looks at numbers, I've seen over and over and over and over and over and over again that what we accept as truth in the thoroughbred world is not only, in many cases, not true, it is detrimental to the sport. And that's where I'm always going to be passionate. I'm always going to make my voice heard when it comes to things that I think are hurting the sport. I have for a long time thought the whole Racino model is ludicrous. At some point, you're going to get the idea if you own a casino and you own a racetrack. Why am I propping up a sport? Why am I propping up a business venture that is losing money when I'm making so much money over here? And of course, we're starting to see that. Actually, we saw it right from the get-go that, you know, tracks really didn't want to race anymore. They just wanted to have the casino. It's a horrible business model. I've spoken out against that. This notion that horses need to rest, the bounce. Mind you, there's a Breeders' Cup bounce. You know, a lot of handicappers believe if you've raced in the Breeders' Cup races, or if you won a Breeders' Cup race, there's no chance that you're going to come back and win. Boy, that has been just turned on its ear in the past couple of years. But this idea that horses need rest, that it is beneficial to them, is nonsense. None of the statistics support it. Everything I've ever done, if I am looking at a form criterion, let's say I'm looking at speed. If there is no time element, it is a worthless factor. The more that you insist that a horse be coming back quickly, the more that becomes a relevant factor. And honestly, it makes sense. Let's be ridiculous about it. at one time, I was reasonably fast. I was never a sprinter. I was never, you know, a guy that could compete on a national level, but I was reasonably fast. Do I look at where I was in high school as an evidence or as evidence of my quickness, of my speed? Of course not. Because I'm 48 now. That was 30 years ago. Now, granted, I'm being absurd. I'm using a super long time span. But in the thoroughbred world, we're talking about horses that typically, especially if they have talent, are racing maybe through their three-year-old campaign, maybe through their four-year-old campaign, 10 races, 15 races, 20 races, total for a career. You don't think time matters? And obviously, horses mature. They get better. And so that's where a lot of this rest stuff comes in. Oh, look, this horse is so much better than it used to be. Yeah, because he's grown up a little bit. You're seeing it with Run Happy. But the two best campaigns, well, let's just talk about the best campaign in the past, I don't know, basically since I've been going to the races, Rachel Alexandra. What did Rachel Alexandra do as a three-year-old? She ran. She competed. There was no hurdle too great for Rachel Alexandra. It was a historical campaign. And it probably wouldn't have happened if Steve Asmussen hadn't taken over the training, if that ownership group hadn't taken over, because the previous ownership group had already mentioned they weren't excited about going up against the males, which Rachel Alexandra did several times with great success, even older males in the Woodward. Then, of course, we heard in the Woodward that, oh, that just gutted her. That was it. No proof, no stats, nothing, but that's the belief. And it's that kind of stuff that is killing racing. So back to Trevor Denman. Talks a little bit about horse welfare. And mind you, all of these crazy theories are sold on that basis. Hey, we're doing right by the horse. Here's what Trevor Denman has to say about improvements in animal care. The claiming game needs to change. When a horse takes a big drop in class, it almost always has a major problem. It is just so callous to say there is something wrong with my horse, you take him. One is risking the horse's life. There should be a rule where you can only drop a horse one level at a time. America needs to catch up with the rest of the world on animal welfare. I know people don't want to hear that, but it is the truth and needs to be said. What does the rest of the world not have that America has? Aren't we told in America that you gotta have Lasix? Wasn't it mentioned in regard to Run Happy that it was cruel? One of the things that I think can be argued that led to Maria Burrell's firing was the idea that Run Happy needed a shot of Butte after the Breeders' Cup Sprint. The ownership group has already stated they're very anti-drug. They don't want to use drugs. I was told by several people on social media that it's cruel not to give a horse Butte. It's cruel not to administer drugs. And I don't know what I'm talking about if I say that I would like to see drugs weaned out of the game. The fact that there were no drugs early on, at least no drugs that were legal early on, is immaterial. The fact that those horses were making 20, 30, 40 starts a year, well, that doesn't matter. They weren't doing right by the horse. None of it makes any sense. And if you look at these other countries, they seem to get that because it's pretty obvious that Lasix is a performance enhancer. Now, you can argue how much. You can argue whether it really does do what it's supposed to do and stop horses from bleeding. But it does boost performance. And we went from a time not that long ago. You know, we're talking the 1960s and 70s. 1975 is kind of the year when most experts agree that's when Lasix kind of made its inroads into the United States. That's when it was started to become widespread. 1975. So we're looking at 40 years. And in 40 years, we went from, again, basically no legal Lasix to now where 95% plus of all horses racing in America are on Lasix. They're all bleeders. They've all got issues. Hard to justify that. Now, I want to quickly turn to sports before we get to Kevin Rogers and talk a little bit about something else that I saw that I thought was goofy. And I think it was Mark Jackson, former NBA player and coach, talked about Steph Curry ruining the game of basketball. And his point was that Steph Curry, who is a prolific three-point shooter, is encouraging kids to take a bunch of three-pointers and not work on the rest of their game. And this had to be the most goofy statement I have ever heard. Because it was just, I don't know, 10 years ago, if that, we were talking about the NBA and the fact that, you know, the game is terrible these days because these kids have no skills. They can't shoot. All they can do is drive to the basket and be like Jordan. Now we get Steph Curry, who comes along. He's this very slight guy. He's undersized. And he's the best player in the NBA, arguably. And this is a bad thing? The fact that now a, you know, kid who doesn't have the physical gifts can actually dream of playing in the NBA if they just become a great shooter? This is a bad thing in the NBA? What is, how do you score? Don't you score by shooting? You score by making baskets? Steph Curry, a 90% plus free throw shooter? How long have we lamented that? You know, how can a pro player be a 50% free throw shooter? How can that happen? How does a guy like Shaquille O'Neal make it in the NBA? He makes it in the NBA because he is a physical freak. How many people are going to be 7'2", 7'3", and weigh 300 pounds? How realistic is that? But we look at Steph Curry, and the guy can shoot the ball, and this is a bad thing. And on that subject, this is where sports in general is backwards. Because you can actually assess what your best course of action is in terms of shooting. This has been done in the NFL with, you know, two-point conversions or just a single one-point conversion. When do you kick a field goal? When do you punt? All of these kinds of things. Sports tends to be very backwards in this area. But I just pulled up some stats because one of the comparisons that was brought up was Larry Bird. You know, Larry Bird, also a very good three-point shooter. I want to say he was 37% for his career. But he just didn't shoot as many three-pointers. But guess what? He should have. He should have shot more. Provided that he can maintain that success rate. That is the one big caveat there. And a lot of times, if guys are shooting more often, and everybody knows what they're going to do, that percentage will drop, which is not the case with Steph Curry. Everybody knows that if he gets an opening, he's going to shoot. He still makes them. But there's a very easy way to assess whether or not it's wiser to take a two-point shot or a three-point shot. You simply take the percentage, your success rate, multiply it by the points allowed, and get values. So Larry Bird, when he took a two-point shot, and by the way, you got to separate the stats because field goals, all field goals are counted in a player's overall shooting percentage. And then the three-point shot is considered separately. So you got to take those three-pointers out of there. Larry Bird, when he shot a two-pointer, he averaged 1.02 points. So that tells you he's a little bit better than a 50% shooter, about 51%. From the three-point line, he averaged 1.13 points. So there's greater value in him shooting a three-pointer. Again, provided he can maintain that percentage. Steph Curry. In fact, before we get to Steph Curry, talk about a player that I was very fond of as a Seattle fan, Fred Brown. Downtown Freddie Brown. Of course, Fred Brown played the majority of his career when there wasn't a three-point shot in the NBA. But when it was instituted, he quickly became the top three-point shooter in the league. For two-point shots, Fred Brown averaged 0.96 points. When he took a three-pointer, 1.12. Fred Brown should have been taking more three-pointers. And even though, you know, he had the nickname Downtown Freddie Brown, he didn't take a lot of outside shots. Or, excuse me, didn't take a lot of three-point shots. He should have. Steph Curry, when he takes a two-point shot, he averages 1 point. So he's about a 50% shooter. A three-point shot, he averages 1.32 points. Of course he should be taking three-pointers. And really, if you want a simple formula, you just have to, your three-point field goal percentage has to be at least two-thirds of your two-point field goal percentage for it to be worth it. If you're above that ratio, you should be taking more three-pointers. It's a pretty simple computation. Steph Curry is, and by the way, a lot of the really good shooters, it shows up in their free throw percentage. A lot of good outside shooters are also very good free throw shooters. Steph Curry, no exception. But to say that Steph Curry is ruining the game. Steph Curry is one of the best things to happen to the NBA ever. And I love the fact, I'm not from Northern California, but I love the Golden State Warriors. I love the way that team plays. They are entertaining. Those years of Showtime and Boston and LA going back and forth with the title, for me, incredibly boring. I guess if you're from that area, you thought that was great to see the Lakers and to see Boston every year. I just didn't think it was that enthralling. Anyway, I'm going to come right back and we're going to talk to Kevin Rogers about the big games this weekend. Looking for some action? Well, if it's sports and casino action you're after, USRacing.com has got you covered. At USRacing.com, you can get the latest betting lines on pro and college football, basketball, and all the MLB and NHL action, too. Heck, you can even get the latest odds in the presidential race, the Academy Awards, or who's going to be the next James Bond. Clue, it's probably not going to be P. Diddy, but he's on the list of betting options. And if you're a racing fan like me, you'll love the daily menu and special prop bets. Thoroughbred racing, check. International racing, check. Greyhound racing, check. Harness racing, check. Generous rebates, checkmate. USRacing.com also has a wide variety of casino games as well. So if you're looking for some sports and casino action, look no further than USRacing.com, the place that's setting the pace.
Now, back to your host. While he's still sober, here's Derek.
Now, here's why you can win.
Every time you lose, you die a little bit. You die inside a portion of you. Not all of your organs, maybe just your liver.
In our business, there is no second place. Either you're first or you're last.
You sick, saucy.
I mean, you walk in that door on your two legs all fat and cocky.
You, me, or nobody. He's gonna hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
See that? That's your IQ, buddy. Zero.
If you look at this play, what we're trying to get is a seal here and a seal here and trying to run this play in the alley.
Remember, we do everything in reps. So it's not two reps of water drinking. Usually we do 10 reps of everything, so do another rep of water drinking.
In the horse racing world, Kentucky Derby time is one of the greatest times of the year, and of course the Breeders' Cup. It's gotta be like Christmas to use a recent holiday for sports bettors at this time of year, huh, Kevin?
Oh, absolutely, Derek, and happy holidays to you. I mean, it's just so busy right now with all these bowls and the college football playoff, which obviously has a lot more steam since it started last year, that now, you know, you have a couple more games to pay attention to, but really this time of year, you have college basketball conference play starting, the NBA still in full force, the NFL playoffs starting. So, yes, it's a very, very busy time of year right now.
I'm talking to Kevin Rogers of VegasInsider.com. And, Kevin, last week we didn't get a chance to talk with the Christmas holiday, but a bunch of upsets in the NFL. Anything you surprised by? And is that something we should look at now in this final week where some teams are playing for, you know, their playoff futures, other teams are not?
You know, looking back at the two biggest upsets with Baltimore and St. Louis both winning, interestingly enough, both pulling off the season sweep of their respective opponent. They look at the Ravens. I was a little shocked by that, but them beating the Steelers the second time and obviously putting a little bit of a dent in Pittsburgh's playoff hopes. They still obviously have a chance to make the playoffs, but you know, you'd think Pittsburgh would go in there as a double-digit favorite and win, and they lose outright. Not to say that I was totally surprised by St. Louis. I had the Rams last week. I thought that they would hang in that game. I would be lying to you if I said they would beat the Seahawks. But I just figured in that spot, I always like this little rule of thumb, that when a team is playing with revenge, especially as a double-digit favorite later on in the season, that it's not really a good look because people want to think, oh, well, like Seattle's going to blow out St. Louis, and that wasn't the case. The Rams jumped out on the Seahawks early and pretty much, you know, it was done with after that. So, you know, I was more surprised with Baltimore winning. I thought St. Louis would hang, but transitioning into this week and seeing, you know, the big upsets, it's going to be hard just because you don't know who's going to sit. You look at the Patriots, you wonder if Tom Brady's going to play a series or two, and then Bill Belichick will sit him. There's just too many unknown factors, which makes Week 17 extremely difficult to handicap.
Hey, Kevin, on the subject of betting, of course, being from Seattle, I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan, also a Denver Broncos fan, which I get a lot of grief from. People tell me, just make a choice. But I saw this little news item about a guy who made a $150,000 bet on the Seahawks on the money line, $150,000 to win $15,000. You know, let's talk a little bit about that and money management. Is that a smart bet, Kevin?
No, no, I just don't believe that. You know, I'm not much of a tennis bettor, but I've heard of people that bet like a ton of money to win a little bit. And they say, oh, this is easy, that I can make easy money here. And chances are you probably win it. It feels like 8 or 9 times out of 10. But when you get these team sports and, you know, especially in football, you know, the Seahawks last week, you know, Russell Wilson obviously didn't get hurt, but what if Russell Wilson got hurt? Then what do? Then you're really in trouble. And I get that in betting that anything can happen. Anybody can get hurt at any time and, you know, you can't do anything about it. But at the same time, I never believed in betting a lot to win a little bit because there are no guarantees. I mean, I'd almost go there if you had, almost in college sports, I'd feel better about it than in the pros. Because in college, you know, if there's an overwhelming favorite, all right, you know, and I get that the money line's not going to be as high for this, but just use it as an example. If Alabama is playing some lower tier Sun Belt team, I feel pretty good about that. They're just going to out-talent the other team. But in the NFL or the NBA, you don't really have a huge talent disparity. Like the Rams are good enough to hang with the Seahawks. Maybe they won't beat them, but they can hang. And obviously, if you get a fumble or you get a turnover and that's enough to get a touchdown and you hold on, then you lose and you say, what did I just waste all my money on?
I think that's my, you know, take on it too. It's one thing, like you were talking about injuries. Yeah, that's true. Injuries could happen at any time for any kind of bet. But when you're getting a decent price, it's not as devastating because that's kind of factored in. But when you're taking a short price, you need everything to go right. And any kind of injury then throws that off and suddenly makes what seemed like a sure bet into one that's, you know, very, very tenuous. And like you said, the talent is so close anyway. Just, you know, I've never understood these. I see it with horse racing, with bridge jumpers. I don't know if it's a tax thing or what people are doing, but I just thought that was kind of funny. What do you got going for this week? I assume we probably got stuff on the college front and the pro front.
Yeah, we're going to concentrate a little bit more on the college just because, like I mentioned with the NFL, you know, with a lot of these Week 17 games, but I'll still give you an NFL play. But with college, a couple things I want to look at. One of them is the Fiesta Bowl on New Year's Day, a very odd setup between Notre Dame and Ohio State playing in Arizona, and it's a 1 o'clock kickoff Eastern, which is an early kick out in Arizona, which I don't understand why it was scheduled for that time, but that's what it is. So, you know, you kind of wonder, it's a big adjustment with these two teams, and obviously with Ohio State playing for the national championship and winning it last year, that now your motivation level is definitely falling off. And that's something that you have to pay attention to in a lot of these bowl games is who's motivated, who's not. When some of these teams have coaches that leave, obviously it's not the case here. Both coaches are there. But I just think with Ohio State, with some of the issues they've had off the field, you know, down the stretch, they had that Michigan State loss where Ezekiel Elliott, he calls out the coaching staff. They come back and they pound Michigan. And I thought that was a very good spot to back the Buckeyes. But now after a month off, there are a lot of these guys that are going to the NFL. Their stock is not going to change after this game. If they're great or horrible, they'll still be drafted where they're going to be drafted coming up in April. So there's not a lot to play for. On Notre Dame's side, this is a team that's covered in all three opportunities as an underdog this year. Both their losses have come by 2 points each to Clemson and Stanford, two quality teams. And I just think that Notre Dame will be a little bit more up for this game. In spite of some of their injuries, you have guys that want to make a mark here, where Ohio State, I hate saying that teams don't have motivation, but they have nothing to play for here. If they win, great. If they lose, so what? I'm going to the NFL. So, and I have a national championship also. So I like Notre Dame there with the points. Another game that I like also in the bowls coming up on Saturday is the Tax Slayer Bowl between Penn State and Georgia in Jacksonville. And this is a situation where the Georgia Bulldogs are without their head coach, with Mark Richt leaving to go to Miami, and now kind of in the middle of things with Kirby Smart, who got hired. but he's not going to coach because he's still working with Alabama. So Georgia's trying to just get through this and transition into their new era with their head coach. I look at Penn State with James Franklin. They've struggled to end the season. They lost three straight. But also James Franklin has a little bit of intel, I'm sure, on Georgia when he was a coach at Vanderbilt. So there's something there, and I'm sure Penn State wants to finish off on a high note, where for Georgia, it doesn't really matter either way. If they win, okay. If they lose, then they still have, you know, they're going to a new coach next year. So I like the points there with Penn State.
Hey, real quick, Kevin, because we were talking a little bit about lame duck coaches, and of course, Cardell Jones of OSU has declared that he's either going to go pro or transfer. How much of an effect does that have on a team? And frankly, why do teams do this? Like, for instance, Philadelphia, you know, they let go of Chip Kelly. Why now? You're not going to salvage the season. Is it a momentum thing? And how do you think that affects teams both on the college and the pro level?
I just wonder that. And, you know, I'll give you my pick in a second in the NFL because it is the Eagles. But, you know, I wonder, yes, the timing of why you would do this. I understand where, you know, some of these coaches may be in the bowl season where they leave. And I'm one proponent, Derek. I've said this for years, that if you're going to leave. Take another job, that's fine. And we saw years ago, I think some coaches ended up coaching the bowl game, which I don't like that. As far as like the same coach before they leave, it's like, no, you want to get a better job, that's fine, go leave. If you want to stay with us, stay with us, but then go to your other job. And now we've seen a lot of these coaches, after they take the job, they leave, which I'm fine with. But back to the point about some of these other, you know, why would they announce this right before? I don't understand the timing of it. I don't understand the timing of the Chip Kelly firing, why you couldn't wait till after Sunday. Nothing's going to change. If you win, who cares? If you lose, who cares? It doesn't matter. You made your decision. So I really don't know on that front. But just sticking with my NFL pick for the Eagles and talking about Chip Kelly, the Eagles are getting 3.5 this week against the Giants in New York. And from everything that it seems like, that the Eagles really had, there was a lot of disconnect with the players, with management, with Chip Kelly, that I kind of feel like now this is like a loosey-goosey game going into the final week of the season, that, again, it doesn't mean much if you win, but you feel a lot better going into this final game to try to finish 7-9, finish ahead of the Giants, pull off the season sweep of your division rival. I look at New York, the way they've melted down here in the last few weeks, that they had the Odell Beckham situation against Carolina. Their defense has been shredded. Tom Coughlin could be out. That I just look at taking the points here with Philadelphia as probably a good look, just because the Eagles maybe have something to salvage with this horrible season.
That's all the time I've got for today. I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank my guest, Kevin Rogers. Hope you have a great New Year's and a great upcoming year, although we won't know that for a while. Take care. Talk to you next week.